of the ground stations would send the missiles off course. The Titan II was the first American long-range missile designed from the outset to have an inertial guidance system. It didn't require any external signals or data to find a target. It was a completely self-contained system that couldn't be jammed, spoofed, or hacked mid-flight. The thinking behind it drew upon ancient navigational rules. If you know exactly where you started, how long you've been traveling, the direction you've been heading, and the speed you've been going the whole time, then you can calculate exactly where you are and how to reach your destination. Dead reckoning, in one form or another, had been used for millennia, especially by captains at sea, and the key to its success was the precision of each measurement. A poor grasp of dead reckoning may have led Christopher Columbus to North America instead of India, a navigational error of about 8,000 miles. On a ship, the essential tools for dead reckoning were a compass, a clock, and a map. On a missile, accelerometers measured speed in three directions. Spinning gyroscopes kept the system aligned with true north, the North Star as a constant reference point. And a small computer counted the time elapsed since launch, calculated the trajectory, and issued a series of instructions. The size of the guidance computer had been unimportant in radio-controlled systems because it was located at the ground station. But size mattered a great deal once the computer was going to be carried by the missile. The Air Force's demand for self-contained, inertial guidance systems played a leading role in the miniaturization of computers and the development of integrated circuits, the building blocks of the modern electronics industry. By 1962, all of the integrated circuits in the United States were being purchased by the Department of Defense, mainly for use in missile guidance systems. Although the Titan II's onboard computer didn't rely on integrated circuits, at only 8 pounds, it was still considered a technological marvel, one of the most powerful small computers ever built. It had about 12.5 kilobytes of memory. Many smartphones now have more than 5 million times that amount. The short-range V-2 had been the first missile to employ an inertial guidance system, and the Nazi scientists who invented it were recruited by the Army's Redstone Arsenal after the Second World War. They later helped to give the Jupiter missile an impressive circular error probable, the radius of the circle around a target, in which half the missiles aimed at it would land, of less than a mile. But the longer a missile flew, the more precise its inertial guidance system had to be. Small errors would be magnified with each passing minute. The guidance system had to take into account factors like the eastward rotation of the Earth. Not only would the target be moving toward the east as the world turned, but so would the point from which the missile was launched. And at different latitudes, the Earth rotates at slightly different speeds. All these factors had to be measured precisely. If the missile's velocity were miscalculated by just 0.05%, the warhead could miss its target by about 20 miles. The accuracy of a Titan II launch would be determined early in the flight. The sequence of events left no room for error. 59 seconds after the commander and the deputy commander turned their keys, the Titan II would rise from the silo, slowly at first, almost pausing for a moment above the open door, before shooting upward, trailed by flames. About 2.5 minutes after liftoff, at an altitude of roughly 47 miles, the thrust chamber pressure switch would sense that most of the oxidizer in the Stage 1 tank had been used. It would shut off the main engine, fire the staging nuts, send Stage 1 of the missile plummeting to Earth, and ignite the Stage 2 engine. About 3 minutes later, at an altitude of roughly 217 miles, the guidance system would detect that the missile had reached the correct velocity. The computer would shut off the Stage 2 engine and fire small vernier engines to make any last-minute changes in speed or direction. The vernier engines would fire for about 15 seconds, and then the computer would blow the nozzles off them and detonate an explosive squib to free the nose cone from Stage 2. The nose cone, holding the warhead, would continue to rise into the sky as the rest of the missile drifted away. About 14 minutes later, the nose cone would reach its apogee, its maximum height, about 800 miles above the Earth. Then it would start to fall, rapidly gaining speed. It would fall for another 16 minutes. It would reach a velocity of about 23,000 feet per second, faster than a speeding bullet, a lot faster, as much as 10 to 20 times faster. And if everything had occurred in the right order, at the right time, precisely, the warhead would detonate within a mile of its target. In addition to creating an accurate guidance system, missile designers had to make sure that a warhead wouldn't incinerate as it re-entered the atmosphere. The friction created by a falling body of that size at those speeds would produce surface temperatures of about 15,000 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than the melting point of any metal. In early versions of the Atlas missile, the nose cone, also called the re-entry vehicle, RV, contained a large block of copper that served as a heat sink. The copper absorbed heat and kept it away from the warhead, but the copper also added a lot of weight to the missile. The Titan II employed a different technique. A thick coating of plastic was added to the nose cone, and during re-entry, layers of the plastic ablated. They charred, melted, vaporized, and absorbed some of the heat. The cloud of gases released by ablation became a buffer in front of the nose cone, a form of insulation, reducing its temperature even further. In addition to protecting the warhead from heat, the nose cone also housed the weapon's arming and fusing system. On the way up, a barometric switch closed when it reached a specific altitude, allowing electricity to flow from the thermal batteries to the warhead. On the way down, an accelerometer ignited the thermal batteries and armed the warhead. If the warhead had been set for an airburst, it exploded at an altitude of 14,000 feet when a barometric switch closed. If the warhead had been set for a ground burst, or if for some reason the barometric switch malfunctioned, it exploded when the piezoelectric crystals in the nose cone were crushed upon impact with the target. Instead of being vaporized by re-entry, the warhead was kept cool and intact long enough to vaporize everything for miles around it. Three strategic missile wings were formed to deploy the Titan II, each with 18 missiles, located in Arkansas, Kansas, and Arizona. The Air Force felt confident that the Titan II would be more reliable than its predecessors. At first, perhaps 70 to 75% of the missiles were expected to hit their targets, and as crews gained experience, that proportion would rise to 90%. Newspapers across the country heralded the arrival of the Titan II, America's superweapon, the biggest guns in the Western world. The missile would play a dual patriotic role in the rivalry with the Soviet Union. It would carry SAC's deadliest warhead, and also serve, in a slightly modified form, as the launch vehicle to send NASA's Gemini astronauts into space. At Little Rock Air Force Base, the introduction of the Titan II was greeted with a nervous enthusiasm. The first launch crews had to train with cardboard mock-ups of equipment, and the number of operational launch complexes in Arkansas soon exceeded the number of crews qualified to run them. Vital checklists were still being written and revised as the missiles were placed on alert. Ben Scalorn became a site maintenance officer for the 308th Strategic Missile Wing, eventually overseeing half a dozen Titan II launch complexes. He liked the new job and didn't hesitate to wear a Refco and work long hours beside his men. Launch Complex 373-4 in Searcy was one of his sites. After the fire killed 53 workers there, he was part of the team that pulled the missile from the silo. It was a sobering experience. Thick black soot covered almost everything, but handprints could still be seen on the rungs of ladders, and the bodies of fallen workers had left clear outlines on the floor. Scalorn could make out the shapes of their arms and legs, the positions of their bodies as they died, surrounded by black soot. All that remained of them were these pale, ghostly silhouettes. Jeff Kennedy was furious. They were just sitting there in the dark at the end of the access road with their thumbs up their asses, doing nothing while the missile got ready to blow. Colonel Morris said they'd been ordered to wait for further instructions, period. The decisions were being made elsewhere, and nothing was to be done without the approval of SAC headquarters. Morris hadn't shared Kennedy's latest plan with the command post, and nobody had asked to hear it. In fact, none of the PTS guys or launch crew members on the scene had been asked to give an opinion of what should be done. Kennedy thought that was bullshit. They were there. They were ready to go. They had all the knowledge and experience you needed. What were they waiting for? Every minute they waited to do the job would make the job more dangerous. At about 10:15, almost 4 hours after the accident, the Disaster Response Force arrived. But its commander, Colonel William Jones, had no authority at the site. A disaster hadn't occurred yet. The five vehicles in his convoy pulled off Highway 65 and parked along the access road. Members of his team got out of their trucks, introduced themselves, and distributed sea rations and cans of water. Colonel Morris asked the flight surgeon who'd come with the ambulance, Captain Donald P. Mueller, to do him a favor. Mueller had never worked with the Disaster Response Force before. He was 28 years old and happened to be the doctor on call at the base hospital that night. Morris asked him to speak with Mazzaro, the missile crew commander. Morris was concerned about Mazzaro. He didn't look well. He seemed anxious and tense. Mueller spent about 45 minutes with Mazzaro, who admitted to feeling worried about his pregnant wife. Mazzaro wanted someone to call his wife and tell her that he was safe. Mueller assured him that she'd already been contacted, and that Fuller's wife, who was also pregnant, had been contacted too. Both women knew their husbands were safe. The news made Mazzaro feel better, and he lay down in the back of the ambulance to rest. Sergeant Brocksmith was having trouble supervising the evacuation of local residents. Colonel Jones and Colonel Morris would periodically sit in his truck and use his radio to speak with the command post. When one of them was on the security police net, Brocksmith's officers couldn't communicate with each other, and his officers didn't have maps of the area, and they didn't have an evacuation plan or any formal guidance about how an evacuation should proceed. The only map that Brocksmith had in his truck showed the location of nearby Titan II complexes, but it didn't show where any houses, farms, schools, or even streets were located. The Missile Potential Hazard Team instructed Brocksmith to post officers in a roughly 3/4 mile radius around 4-7. Two missile alarm response teams were available for the job, and a couple of mobile fire teams, MFTs, had been sent from Little Rock. That gave Brocksmith 10 military police officers to secure the area. The MARTs were trained to guard Titan II sites, the MFTs to defend the airbase from sabotage and attack using machine guns, grenade launchers, and M16 rifles. The MFTs, most of whom had never seen a Titan II complex, left their machine guns and grenade launchers in Little Rock. Brocksmith established roadblocks on Highway 65 and stationed officers on County Roads 836 and 26, a pair of dirt roads that crossed the highway north and south of the missile complex. The officers on County Road 836 were forced to stop short of their assigned position. They'd encountered an old wooden bridge, and they were afraid to drive their truck over it. The military police had no legal jurisdiction on civilian property and couldn't order anyone to evacuate. As officers knocked on doors in the middle of the night, carrying flashlights and M16s, they found that most of the houses were empty. Sheriff Anglin or the state police had already been there. The handful of residents who'd refused to leave their homes generally fell into two categories. Some were stubborn and defiant, while others, like Sam Hutto, were sneaky. Hutto kept returning to his farm on back roads to look after the cows. The roughly 200 officers in the security police squadron had been recalled to Little Rock Air Force Base. Sergeant Donald V. Green was serving as a referee at a football game when he heard about the recall. Green quickly went home, changed into his uniform, and reported for duty. He was in his early 30s, born and raised in Old Town, Florida, a small rural community about 40 miles west of Gainesville. He lived on the base with his wife and 6-year-old son, and he loved being a military police officer, despite how most people viewed the job. Being a cook or a cop, those were the only two jobs at SAC that nobody seemed to want. Too often, he thought, guys who'd flunked out of every technical school in the Air Force would be assigned to the military police. But the camaraderie among the officers was strong, their work interesting and important, even if it was rarely appreciated. Green was the non-commissioned officer in charge of training at the 308th. He taught MART teams everything they needed to know about the Titan II. The teams escorted warheads to and from launch sites, kept an eye on warheads as they were being mated to missiles, and responded whenever an alarm went off. Officers learned how to deal with anti-war protesters, saboteurs, and all sorts of false alarms. A bird flying past the tipsies could set them off, and then a 2-man MART team would have to visit the site and investigate what had tripped them, because the complexes didn't have security cameras topside. A missile crew had no way of knowing whether the tipsies had been set off by a squirrel or a squad of Soviet commandos. A MART team usually stayed overnight at a launch control center in each sector, using that home complex as a base to oversee security at 3 or 4 neighboring sites. 4-7 often served as a home complex, and one of Sergeant Green's teams had pointed out a major security breach there just a few weeks before the accident. Green had been amazed by their discovery. You could break into a Titan II complex with just a credit card. Once the officers showed him how to do it, Green requested permission to stage a black hat operation at 4-7, an unannounced demonstration of how someone could sneak into the launch control center undetected. SAC had a long history of black hatting to test the security at its facilities. Black hat teams would plant phony explosives on bombers, place metal spikes on runways, infiltrate a command post, and then hand a letter to the base commander that said, "You're dead." General LeMay liked to run these tests and to punish officers who failed them. After Green received the go-ahead to stage a black hat at 4-7, his men secretly practiced the break-in. On the day of the exercise, Green and 2 of his officers, Donald G. Moles Jr. and Larry Crowder, began the subterfuge by setting off the tipsies at Launch Complex 374-8, about 10 miles from Damascus in the town of Little Texas. When the alarm sounded there, the MART team stationed at 4-7 got a call and drove off to see what was wrong. Green and his men hurried to Damascus, jumped the perimeter fence at 4-7, carefully avoided the radar beams that set off the tipsies, and entered the access portal. Green picked up the phone and told the missile crew commander that General Wyatt, a fictitious high-ranking officer, needed to see a schematic drawing in one of the technical manuals. When the crew commander hesitated, Green demanded his name and warned him the general would be unhappy with that response. The commander said he'd look for the drawing right away. Taking advantage of the distraction, Crowder and Moles jimmied the lock on the outer steel door with an ID card, ran down the stairs, and within seconds jimmied the door at the entrapment area too. The men ran past the only security camera at the launch complex, but the missile crew wasn't looking at the television monitor. They were probably searching for that tech drawing, and the entrapment area didn't have a microphone to capture the sounds of a break-in. Green ran back to the perimeter fence, climbed over it, got into his truck, drove a safe distance from the launch complex, and parked. Crowder and Moles hid outside blast door 6, waiting. When the MART team returned from the false alarm at the other launch site, it was given permission to re-enter 4-7. The team was buzzed through the first two doors and walked downstairs to blast door 6, where it was surprised to hear a voice say, "You're dead." One of Green's men picked up the phone there and said, "Security team at blast door 6. The door was opened, as were blast doors 7 and 8. Crowder and Moles walked into the control center, feeling awfully pleased. Steel plates were soon welded to the outer doors at Titan 2 sites so that intruders would need more than a credit card. The drive to Damascus seemed to be taking forever as the PTS convoy picked up equipment at 2 launch complexes, made 3 stops, and obeyed the speed limit. "I've got a bad feeling about this," Senior Airman David Livingston said. "Somebody's going to die out there tonight." The other members of Team B didn't like hearing Livingston talk that way. He wasn't a fearful or high-strung type. He was one of the most easy-going, laid-back guys at the base. If anything, Livingston was too laid-back. He'd become legendary for his ability to sleep just about anywhere, anytime. And once he was out, it was almost impossible to wake him. Jeff Kennedy would sometimes have to bang on Livingston's door in the morning and yell at him and literally drag him out of bed. But nobody really minded, because once he was awake and alert, Livingston worked hard. He knew how to fix things. He was constantly tinkering with mechanical objects in his spare time, with citizens' band radios, lawnmower engines, transmissions, and the old VW Beetle that he'd bought a few years earlier, right after graduating from high school. He loved to ride motorcycles and could pop a wheelie, lean back in the seat, and cruise. During the previous summer, Livingston had visited his family in Heath, Ohio, a small town surrounded by cornfields in the central part of the state, where his father drove a truck and his mother worked as a clerk at a nearby Air Force base. He'd ridden his motorcycle there and back for a long weekend, a round trip of about 1,500 miles. He lived off base in a double-wide trailer, planned to ask his landlord's niece to marry him, and couldn't decide whether to move with her to California or sign on for another 4 years with SAC. The hardest part about leaving the Air Force, Livingston thought, would be saying goodbye to his loud, rowdy PTS buddies. They felt like family. Senior Airman Greg Devlin was riding next to Livingston in the truck. At first, he thought Livingston was joking about the bad vibes and the premonition of death. But it wasn't funny. And then Livingston said it again. "Somebody's going to die tonight. I can feel it."
"Don't even be kidding around with stuff like that," Devlin said. "Don't even be talking about that."
Devlin wasn't very superstitious. He just didn't like to dwell on bad things. The job was full of risks. And if something dangerous had to be done, his attitude was, "Okay, let's go do it." There was no use talking about it or thinking about it too much. He was the type of person who instinctively ran toward a fire, not from it. And he didn't like to waste time worrying about it first. Devlin, like Livingston, had grown up in Ohio, graduated from high school in 1977, and joined the Air Force that year. Devlin had to miss his high school graduation. It was held the day after he reported for duty. During basic training, he was 17 years old. His father and his uncles had been Marines, but Devlin was drawn to the Air Force. He wanted to become a pilot or an airplane mechanic. The Air Force decided instead that he would become a Titan II propellant transfer system technician. At training school, he desperately missed his high school sweetheart, Annette Buchanan. With her mother's blessing, they soon got married, and Annette joined him in Arkansas. She was 16. The newlyweds started out in a small trailer and then made a down payment on their first house when Devlin turned 19. The house was in Jacksonville, not far from Little Rock Air Force Base. His friends didn't like to throw parties in the dormitories because they always had to worry about the dorm monitors and the dorm guards. And so almost every weekend, the parties were held at Devlin's house. A fair amount of alcohol was consumed, and if a party got a little out of hand, Devlin knew how to deal with it. He was friendly, courteous, even-tempered, and a Golden Gloves boxer just like his father, his uncles, and one of his grandfathers had been. Devlin trained at a local gym. He fought as a junior middleweight and had recently scored 5 straight knockouts. When he asked people to quiet down at a party, they generally did. At the command post, a checklist was slowly being prepared. Each step had to be discussed on the missile potential hazard net and then approved by General Levitt. Colonel Moser spoke on behalf of his team after listening to the recommendations of the K crew and everyone else on the net. At about 11 o'clock, a consensus seemed to have emerged, and Moser read the latest plan aloud. 1. An airman in a Refco suit would carry a portable vapor detector to one of the silo's exhaust vents, place the detector's probe into the white cloud rising from the vent, and measure the amount of fuel vapor. The measurement would give them a sense of whether the silo was safe to enter. At a level of about 18,000 parts per million, ppm, the Refco would start to melt. At 20,000 ppm, the fuel vapor could spontaneously combust without any exposure to a spark or flame, just from the friction caused by the movement of air. Waving your hand through the fuel vapor at that concentration could ignite it. The portable vapor detector, a blue rectangular steel box that weighed about 12 pounds with a round gauge on top, wasn't an ideal instrument for the task. It pegged out and shut off when the vapor level reached a maximum of 250 ppm. But it was the best they had. 2. If the proportion of fuel vapor rising from the exhaust shaft was lower than 200 ppm, a couple of airmen in Refcos would enter the launch complex through the access portal. Everybody at the hazard net agreed that the escape hatch was too narrow for someone in a Refco suit to fit through it. 3. After proceeding through the 2 outer doors, the airmen would open blast doors 6 and 7 manually with a portable hydraulic pump. Using electricity to open the blast doors might create a spark. 4. The airmen would enter the blast lock and look at the readout from the mine safety appliance. It would tell them the vapor level in the silo. If the level was below 200 ppm, the men would open blast door 9, walk down the long cableway, enter the silo, and vent the stage 1 fuel tank. 5. The airmen would bring a portable vapor detector with them, and if it registered a vapor level higher than 200 ppm at any point during those first 4 steps, the men would get out of the launch complex as quickly as possible, leaving the doors open behind them. Colonel Scallorn wasn't happy with part of the plan. He was concerned about the rising heat in the silo, the risk that an oxidizer tank would rupture from the heat, and the huge explosion that would follow. Working outdoors with PTS teams, he'd seen how sensitive the oxidizer could be to small increases in temperature. On a cold, clear day at a launch site in Arkansas, the stainless steel mesh of an oxidizer hose could get warm enough just from lying in the sun to blow off a poppet. He thought it would be foolish to enter the silo without knowing the tank pressures inside the missile. It wasn't worth the risk. It would put these young men in harm's way. Over the years, he'd found that some people at SAC headquarters treated maintenance crews and PTS guys like they were expendable. Scallorn suggested on the net that the 2 airmen should enter the launch control center first, check the tank pressures on the PTPMU, and turn on the purge fan to clear fuel vapor from the silo. They could always go into the silo later. General Levitt didn't appreciate the suggestion. "Scallorn, just be quiet and stop telling people what to do," he snapped. "We're trying to figure this thing out." "Roger, General," Scallorn replied. "You got that, Moser?" It was an awkward moment. Nobody liked to hear one of SAC's leading Titan II experts being told to shut up. Not long afterward, Charles E. Carnahan, a vice president at Martin Marietta who'd been quietly listening to the discussion, spoke up. "Little Rock, this is Martin Denver," Carnahan said. "Are you interested in any of our judgments in this matter?"
Of course, Levitt told him. Go ahead. If it was us, we would seriously consider not moving into the silo area for some number of hours. Carnahan was asked if he meant the silo or the entire launch complex. I am talking about the launch complex, he said. It is entirely possible that the leak is still leaking. It is our judgment that while the leak continues, the vapor content in the silo and the general area will continue to rise. The potential for a monopropellic explosion increases as the vapor content increases. Once the leak has leaked out, if you have no explosion, it is our judgment that the vapor content in the area will decrease. We are unclear as to the gain that is expected from an early entry, or an entry at this point in time into the complex area. After hours of debating what to do, the missile potential hazard team now had to ponder the advice of the company that built the missile. Do nothing. A small group of reporters stood along Highway 65 watching the Air Force trucks roll up. It was about 11:30, and Sid King was impressed by all the Air Force personnel and equipment that suddenly appeared. Crews from the local television stations in Little Rock pointed their lights and cameras at the vehicles as military police tried to keep the press off the access road. A cattle guard about 30 feet from the highway served as the line that civilians were prohibited to cross. The questions shouted by reporters were ignored. Sergeant Joseph W. Cotton, the public affairs officer who'd arrived with the disaster response force, had already told the press that there was a fuel leak and it was under control. Cotton refused to say anything more, and he gave reporters the phone number of SAC headquarters in Omaha in case they had any further questions. King and his friend Tom Phillips thought about sneaking closer to the launch complex to see what was happening. King knew Ralph and Reba Joe Parrish, who owned the farm to the north of the missile site. Although the Parrishes had been evacuated, King was sure they wouldn't mind his entering the property and heading west through their fields toward the silo. King and Phillips quietly discussed the plan, feeling confident they wouldn't get caught. It was dark out there, but they wondered what would happen if they were caught, and decided, for the time being, to stay put. PTS Team B unloaded their gear just past the cattle guard, along the road to the launch complex, relying on flashlights to see what they were doing. The television crews had better lights. Man, those look like spacesuits, Sid King thought, as the refcos and their helmets were unpacked. He was struck by how young the airmen appeared. He'd expected to see gray-haired scientists and high-ranking Air Force officers coming to fix the missile. These guys were younger than him. They were kids. Once the refcos were laid out, the air packs filled, and everything ready to go, Sergeant Hansen walked over to Colonel Morris. He told Morris that a couple of people would be sent through the access portal into the silo. Colonel Morris hadn't heard anything about a plan to re-enter the complex. Hey, wait a minute, Morris said. We're not doing anything until I get directions. Morris got on the radio to the command post and asked, what's the plan? He was told to stand by. They were still working on it. Colonel Moser asked SAC headquarters if they should follow Martin Marietta's advice. Well, let's go over what we've got here, General Levitt said. About 30 minutes earlier, Levitt had called Governor Clinton in Hot Springs. Their conversation was brief and polite. He told Clinton that a team was about to re-enter the complex and that the situation was under control. Clinton thanked him for the update and went to bed. But Levitt had changed his mind. He decided that they should wait and allow the fuel vapor to dissipate before sending anyone near the missile. And he asked everyone on the net to discuss what had happened at 4-7 from the moment the socket was dropped. Jeff Kennedy lay on the grass atop a low hill. Silas Spann, a member of PTS Team B, sat beside him. Spann was one of the few African Americans who worked in missile maintenance, and he stood out in this part of rural Arkansas. Whenever he walked into one of the local shops, people looked surprised. Kennedy and Spann could see the launch complex down below. A thick white cloud still floated from the vents. The two men wondered what would happen if the missile exploded. Would the blast doors and the silo door hold? Would they fully contain the blast? Both agreed that the doors would. They had faith in those big fucking doors. It was a warm, beautiful night with a slight breeze and plenty of stars in the sky. Don Green was at Little Rock Air Force Base guarding the weapons storage area around midnight when a new set of officers came on duty. Green was told that he could go home. Before leaving, he stopped by Central Security Control to see if anybody needed help. He bumped into another security officer, Sergeant Jimmy Roberts, who'd come there for the same reason. Roberts worked across the hall from Green, and the two were friends. They both felt like being useful. It was a busy night. A third security officer walked into the office and asked for a map. He was supposed to escort a flatbed truck carrying an all-terrain forklift to Launch Complex 3747, but didn't know how to get there. The job sounded pretty urgent. They needed the forklift to haul light all units onto the complex so that the PTS team could see what they were doing. Green and Roberts said they'd be glad to escort the flatbed. They knew the way and could get the forklift out there fast. Instead of going home and getting into bed, they got into a pickup and headed to Damascus. Colonel Moser left the missile potential hazard net and used the security police net to speak directly with Morris. It was almost 1 a.m. and a decision had been made. He told Morris that 3 airmen should put on REFCO suits. A checklist had been prepared, and Moser wanted him to copy it down word for word. Morris grabbed a piece of paper and a pencil, and while sitting in the front seat of Brock Smith's truck, copied down the instructions. It was the same checklist that the command post had prepared 2 hours earlier, except that the 200 ppm fuel vapor limit had been raised to 250 ppm. Morris spent 15 minutes listening carefully and writing down exactly what Moser said. They finished, and then Moser paused, told him to stand by, and signed off. Morris sat in the truck, waiting. 20 minutes later, Colonel Moser was on the radio again. There was a slight change of plan. Instead of entering the silo, the 2 airmen in REFCOs should enter the control center. Moser stressed that the men should avoid passing through any fuel vapor. He didn't want anyone to get hurt. And he passed along General Levitt's instructions that no electrical switch should be turned on or off without permission from SAC headquarters. Colonel Morris left the truck, gathered the members of PTS Team B, and read them the final checklist. He went through every step, and he said, "We don't want any heroes out there. We'll do exactly what's on the paper, and that's all, and then we're all going to come back." "Colonel, this is unreal," Jeff Kennedy said. Kennedy could not believe that this was the plan. It was insane. It made absolutely no sense to send men into the launch complex through the access portal instead of the escape hatch. The access portal was a much more dangerous route. If you went through the escape hatch, the trip to the control center would be quick and direct, and you wouldn't have to open any blast doors with a goddamn hand pump. If you went through the escape hatch, you'd be protected by the blast doors, not impeded by them. And the escape hatch was on the opposite side of the complex from the missile. The access portal was a lot closer to the missile. Why send anyone in there? Of course, you'd have to sample for fuel vapor every step of the way. You'd be in danger every step of the way. To reach the control center, the men would have to pass through the blast lock, and it was full of fuel vapor 6 hours ago when PTS Team A opened the door a crack, took a peek, and then had to slam it shut. Why send anyone down the longest, most dangerous, most likely to be contaminated route? Kennedy thought this checklist must have been written by somebody who'd never set foot on a Titan II complex. Of course you can fit a man in Refco through the escape hatch, Kennedy argued. He'd just been through the escape hatch, so he ought to know.
Kennedy, this is the plan, Morris said. This is the plan that's come down, and that's it. End of discussion.
Sergeant Hansen had selected the three men who'd enter the complex and the three who would wait in Refco's, halfway down the access road as backup. Kennedy wasn't one of them. Kennedy and Hansen didn't get along. Hansen wished Kennedy had returned to the base with the rest of PTS Team A. As team chief, Hansen was in charge of this operation. He didn't think you could fit through the escape hatch in a Refco. He liked the checklist, and if Kennedy didn't, that was too bad. David Livingston, Greg Devlin, and Rex Huckle, a farm boy from Kansas, climbed into the back of a pickup truck wearing their Refcos. Colonel Morris got into the front seat along with Hansen and Captain George Short, chief of the field maintenance branch at the 308th. Before the truck drove down the road to the complex, Jeff Kennedy jumped into the back. Outside the gate, Livingston, Devlin, and Huckle drew straws to see who would be the first to go in. Walking over to the exhaust vent alone as fuel vapor poured out of it seemed like a brave thing to do. All of them were willing, but this felt like the best way to choose. David Livingston drew the short straw. Before anyone could enter the launch complex, a hole had to be cut in the chain-link fence. The gate was still locked, nobody had the key, and climbing over the fence in a Refco could tear the suit. Morris, Hansen, and Short spent about 15 minutes making a hole with bolt cutters. They finished at 2 in the morning. Livingston put on his helmet and his air pack and prepared to go in. Although the pack was designed to hold an hour's worth of air, the command post had instructed that it should be used for just half an hour. The air packs were considered unreliable, and running out of air amid a thick cloud of fuel vapor could kill you. Hansen and Morris got into the front seat of the truck. Morris would stay in touch with the command post on the security police net, and Hansen would talk to Livingston on the radio network at the launch complex. The two radio systems were incompatible. If General Levitt wanted to give Livingston an order, Levitt would have to tell Moser, who would have to tell Morris, who would have to tell Hansen, who would have to tell Livingston. Although Hansen had brought along a repeater to strengthen the signal, reception on the complex was spotty. Carrying a flashlight and a vapor detector, Livingston went through the hole in the fence. He saw a cloud of white vapor streaming from the silo's exhaust vents, like steam from a boiling kettle. He entered the complex, crossed the gravel near the hard stand, and approached one of the vents. Hansen had told him to get the vapor detector as close as possible to the cloud, without getting engulfed in it if the wind shifted. Livingston stuck the probe into the mist, and the needle on the gauge shot all the way to the right. "The portable vapor detector has pegged out," Livingston said. Hansen told Morris, who informed the command post. The news was shared with everyone on the net. Colonel Scallorn thought the mission was over. The detector had pegged out. Sergeant Hansen told Livingston to put his hand over the vent and try to get a sense of the vapor temperature. Hansen had meant to bring a thermometer from the base, but had forgotten it. Scallorn kept expecting someone on the net to call it off and bring this boy back to the truck. He didn't understand why they were sending anyone into the complex at 2 in the morning. They'd already waited more than 7 hours to do something. It seemed too late now. Livingston put his hand over the metal grate. He could feel the heat through his glove. Colonel Morris told the command post that he was bringing Livingston back. Livingston returned from the complex, took off his helmet, and leaned against the bed of the pickup. "It's hot as hell over there," he said. At the command post, members of the K crew assumed that the mission was over. The fuel vapor hadn't dissipated, like Martin Marietta had suggested it would, and the portable vapor detector couldn't reveal how high the level really was. It was at least 250 ppm, the cutoff mark that everyone had agreed upon. SAC headquarters ordered Devlin and Huckle to enter the launch complex. The men put on their helmets and air packs and grabbed their equipment. They had a lot more gear than Livingston. Between the two of them, Devlin and Huckle carried a portable vapor detector, flashlights, the hydraulic hand pump, and a tool bag holding screwdrivers, crescent wrenches, and pliers. They also brought a couple of crowbars. The outer steel door and the door at the bottom of the entrapment area were locked and could no longer be jimmied open with a credit card. Devlin and Huckle would have to break into the launch complex with crowbars. Nobody knew how difficult that would be, since nobody there had ever done it. The two young airmen in Refco suits, holding their flashlights and crowbars and tools, went through the hole in the fence. Part 4. Out of Control. Decapitation. On January 23, 1961, a B-52 bomber took off from Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in Goldsboro, North Carolina, for an airborne alert. The flight plan was a long circular route along the East Coast. At the end of the first loop, the B-52 met its tanker a couple of minutes early and refueled. At the end of the second loop, after more than 10 hours in the air, the bomber refueled again. It was almost midnight. Amid the darkness, the boom operator of the tanker noticed fuel leaking from the B-52's right wing. Spray from the leak soon formed a wide plume, and within 2 minutes about 40,000 gallons of jet fuel had poured from the wing. The command post at Seymour Johnson told the pilot, Major Walter S. Tulloch, to dump the rest of the fuel in the ocean and prepare for an emergency landing. But fuel wouldn't drain from the tank inside the left wing, creating a weight imbalance. At 12:30, with the flaps down and the landing gear extended, the B-52 went into an uncontrolled spin. Major Tulloch heard a loud explosion and ordered his crew to bail out as the plane started to break apart at an altitude of 10,000 feet. Four of the men ejected safely, including Tulloch. First Lieutenant Adam C. Maddox managed to jump through the escape hatch while the bomber was upside down and survived. Major Eugene Shelton ejected but suffered a fatal head injury. The radar navigator, Major Eugene H. Richards, and Technical Sergeant Francis R. Barnish died in the crash. The B-52 was carrying two Mark 39 hydrogen bombs, each with a yield of 4 megatons. As the aircraft spun downward, centrifugal forces pulled a lanyard in the cockpit. The lanyard was attached to the bomb release mechanism. When the lanyard was pulled, the locking pins were removed from one of the bombs. The Mark 39 fell from the plane. The arming wires were yanked out, and the bomb responded as though it had been deliberately released by the crew above a target. The pulse generator activated the low-voltage thermal batteries. The drogue parachute opened, and then the main chute. The barometric switches closed. The timer ran out, activating the high-voltage thermal batteries. The bomb hit the ground, and the piezoelectric crystals inside the nose crushed. They sent a firing signal, but the weapon didn't detonate. Every safety mechanism had failed except one, the ready-safe switch in the cockpit. The switch was in the safe position when the bomb dropped. Had the switch been set to ground or air, the X-unit would have charged, the detonators would have triggered, and a thermonuclear weapon would have exploded in a field near Faro, North Carolina. When Air Force personnel found the Mark 39 later that morning, the bomb was harmlessly stuck in the ground nose first, its parachute draped in the branches of a tree. The other Mark 39 plummeted straight down and landed in a meadow just off Big Daddy's Road near the Nahunta Swamp. Its parachutes had failed to open. The high explosives did not detonate, and the primary was largely undamaged. But the dense uranium secondary of the bomb penetrated more than 70 feet into the soggy ground. A recovery team never found it,
despite weeks of digging. The Air Force assured the public that the two weapons had been unarmed and that there was never any risk of a nuclear explosion. Those statements were misleading. The T-249 control box and ready safe switch, installed in every one of SAC's bombers, had already raised concerns at Sandia. The switch required a low-voltage signal of brief duration to operate, and that kind of signal could easily be provided by a stray wire or a short circuit, as a B-52 full of electronic equipment disintegrated mid-air.
A year after the North Carolina accident, a SAC ground crew removed four Mark 28 bombs from a B-47 bomber and noticed that all of the weapons were armed. But the seal on the ready safe switch in the cockpit was intact, and the knob hadn't been turned to ground or air. The bombs had not been armed by the crew. A 7-month investigation by Sandia found that a tiny metal nut had come off a screw inside the plane and lodged against an unused radar heating circuit. The nut had created a new electrical pathway, allowing current to reach an arming line and bypass the ready safe switch. A similar glitch on the B-52 that crashed near Goldsboro would have caused a 4-megaton thermonuclear explosion. It would have been bad news in spades, Parker F. Jones, a safety engineer at Sandia, wrote in a memo about the accident. One simple dynamo technology low-voltage switch stood between the United States and a major catastrophe. With strong northerly winds, the groundburst of that 4-megaton bomb in Goldsboro would have deposited lethal fallout over Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York City. And the timing would have been unfortunate. The new president of the United States, John F. Kennedy, had delivered his inaugural address only 3 days earlier, promising renewal and change, vowing to pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty. The spirit of youthful optimism sweeping the United States would have been dimmed by the detonation of a hydrogen bomb in North Carolina and an evacuation of the nation's capital. The Goldsboro accident, far from being an isolated or improbable event, was a portent of the nuclear threats that the Kennedy administration would have to confront. Robert S. McNamara, the new Secretary of Defense, learned about the accident during his third day on the job. The story scared the hell out of him. McNamara knew remarkably little about nuclear weapons. The previous month, when Kennedy had asked him to head the Department of Defense, McNamara was the president of the Ford Motor Company. He was a young, supremely self-confident businessman devoted to systems analysis and efficiency. At the Harvard Business School, he'd taught accounting. Aside from a 3-year stint in the Army Air Forces, where he'd served in the Office of Statistical Control and helped General LeMay calculate optimal fuel use for the bombing of Japan, McNamara had no military experience, and he'd spent little time thinking about military strategy or procurement. Determined to shake things up at the Pentagon, McNamara found himself instead feeling profoundly shaken during his first week on the job. The B-52 crash in North Carolina wasn't the only accident that involved fully assembled sealed pit weapons, and McNamara soon learned about others. A B-47 carrying a Mark 39 bomb had caught fire while taking off at Dyess Air Force Base near Abilene, Texas. At an altitude of about 200 feet, the pilot realized the plane was on fire, banked to avoid a populated area, and ordered the crew to bail out. 3 of the 4 crew members got out in time. The plane entered a vertical dive, hit the ground, and vanished in a fireball. The high explosives of the hydrogen bomb detonated but didn't produce a nuclear yield. A few weeks later, a B-47 carrying a Mark 39 bomb caught fire on the runway at Chenault Air Force Base in Lake Charles, Louisiana. The crew escaped, and the weapon didn't explode. It melted into radioactive slag. In the skies above Hardinsburg, Kentucky,
A B-52 carrying two hydrogen bombs collided with a tanker while attempting to refuel. The crew of the B-52 heard a crunching sound. All the lights went out, the cabin rapidly decompressed, and the plane began to disintegrate. Four of the crew ejected safely. The other four were killed, as were all four members of the tanker's crew. The wreckage of the two planes covered an area of roughly 27 square miles. The hydrogen bombs were torn open by the crash. The nuclear cores of their primaries were discovered intact, resting on piles of broken high explosives. At an air defense site in Jackson Township, New Jersey, a helium tank ruptured near a Bomark missile, starting a fire. A pair of explosions soon followed inside the concrete shelter that housed the missile. 55 other Bomarks lay in similar shelters beneath corrugated steel roofs nearby. When emergency personnel arrived, the fire was out of control. They put fire hoses in the entrances to the burning shelter and fled the area. An Air Force security officer called the state police and mistakenly reported that a nuclear weapon had exploded at the site, spreading panic throughout central New Jersey and prompting civil defense authorities to go on full alert in New York City, 70 miles to the north. Fallout from the Bomark's 10-kiloton warhead, it was feared, could reach Trenton, the state capital, Princeton, Newark, and possibly Manhattan. Firefighters returned to the missile site about an hour and a half after the initial explosions and put out the fire. The warhead had fallen out of the nose cone. The high explosives had burned instead of detonating, and the nuclear core had melted onto the floor. The shelter contained most of the radioactivity, but water from the fire hoses had swept plutonium residue under the doors, down the street, and into a drainage ditch. The accidents in North Carolina and Texas worried Robert McNamara the most. In one crash, the failure of a single mechanical switch could have led to a full-scale thermonuclear explosion. In the other, the detonation of the Mark 39's high explosives was the sort of one-point safety test that you never want to conduct in the real world. The Mark 39 had passed the test, this time. It wasn't something that McNamara wanted to see repeated. The lapses in weapon safety seemed to be part of a much larger problem, a sense of disarray and mismanagement at the Pentagon, extending from the budget process to the planning for nuclear war. In his view, the Department of Defense had been saddled with the previous administration's intellectual bankruptcy in both strategic policy and in the force structure. McNamara was determined to bring order, rational management, and common sense to the workings of the Pentagon as quickly as possible. During the 1960 campaign, John F. Kennedy had repeatedly attacked President Eisenhower for allowing the Soviet Union to surpass the United States in military power. The communists will have a dangerous lead in intercontinental missiles through 1963, the platform of the Democratic Party declared, and the Republican administration has no plans to catch up. Kennedy argued that Eisenhower's strategy of massive retaliation had left the United States in a helpless position, unable to prevent the Soviets from subverting and overthrowing governments friendly to the West. An over-reliance on nuclear weapons had made American promises to defend the free world seem hollow. We have been driving ourselves into a corner where the only choice is all or nothing at all, world devastation or submission, Kennedy warned. General Maxwell Taylor's book, The Uncertain Trumpet, and its call for a nuclear strategy of flexible response had greatly impressed Kennedy. He agreed with Taylor's central thesis. In a crisis, the president should have a wide range of military options. Kennedy wanted the ability to fight limited wars, conventional wars, and a nuclear war with the Soviets that could be stopped short of mutual annihilation. Controlled response and controlled escalation and pauses for negotiation became buzzwords in the Kennedy administration. If the American military had the means to prevail in a variety of different ways, with or without nuclear weapons, the United States could resist Soviet influence throughout the world. The record of the Romans made clear, Kennedy later told his national security staff, that their success was dependent on their will and ability to fight successfully at the edges of their empire. Despite the harsh personal attacks during the presidential campaign, Eisenhower helped the new administration with its reappraisal of nuclear strategy. His science advisor's memo on the shortcomings of the single integrated operational plan was forwarded to McNamara and Kennedy. The memo supported many of the arguments against the PSYOP made by General Taylor and leading officers in the Navy. The chief of naval operations, Admiral Arleigh Burke, warned that such a large, undiscriminating attack on the Soviet Union would deposit lethal fallout not only on American allies like South Korea and Japan, but also on the U.S. Navy's Pacific Fleet. A reappraisal of the nation's entire military stance now seemed urgent, and President Kennedy asked McNamara to lead it, to raise fundamental questions about how weapons were procured, what purpose they served, and whether they were even necessary. Although a year older than the president, McNamara, at 44, was the youngest person thus far to head the Department of Defense, and he recruited a group of cocky and iconoclastic young men to join the administration, academics from Harvard and MIT, RAND analysts, economists, Rhodes scholars. Henry Rowan, a graduate of Harvard and Oxford who soon played a large role in nuclear planning, was 36. Harold Brown, chosen to guide Pentagon research on new weapons systems and technology, was 33. Alain Enthoven, an economist who rigorously applied cost-benefit analysis to the defense budget, was 30. Later depicted as whiz kids, defense intellectuals, the best and the brightest, McNamara's team was determined to transform America's nuclear strategy and defense spending. 3 days after the Goldsboro accident, McNamara met with members of the Pentagon's Weapons Systems Evaluation Group, WSEG. It had recently completed a study, WSEG Report No. 50, that described the Soviet forces the United States would most likely face by the mid-1960s and compared the merits of different tactics to oppose them. Eisenhower's Secretary of Defense, Thomas B. Gates, had seen the report a few months earlier and thought McNamara should know about it. McNamara's briefing on WSEG Report No. 50, scheduled to last a few hours, wound up occupying a full day. The authors of the report had measured the economic efficiency of various American weapons systems, explaining, for example, that the annual operating costs of keeping a B-52 bomber on ground alert was about 9 times larger than the annual maintenance costs of a Minuteman missile. That was just the sort of data that Robert McNamara craved. But the authors of WSEG R-50 had also reached a conclusion that nobody in the Kennedy administration wanted to hear. America's command and control system was so complex, outdated, and unreliable that a controlled or flexible response to a Soviet attack would be impossible. In fact, the President of the United States might not be able to make any response. He would probably be killed during the first moments of a nuclear war. By launching a surprise attack on 5 targets, the White House, the Pentagon, Camp David, Site R, and High Point, the Soviet Union had a good chance of wiping out the civilian leadership of the United States. None of the bunkers at those locations would survive the blast from a multi-megaton weapon. And 2 of the emergency command posts, Site R and High Point, weren't regularly staffed with high-ranking officers. By hitting 9 additional targets, the Soviet Union could eliminate America's military leadership. The destruction of America's command and control system could be achieved with a 90% chance of success through the use of only 35 Soviet missiles. 4 would be aimed at the White House and 5 at Camp David to ensure that the president was killed. Under surprise attack conditions, there can be little confidence, the report concluded, that the presidential decision would be made and military execution orders be received by the combat elements of the strategic nuclear forces before the high command is disrupted.
Moreover, the command bunkers built during the Eisenhower years lacked the communications equipment that would allow the controlled escalation of a nuclear war or pauses for negotiation with the Soviets, even if the president survived the initial attack. The high-frequency radio system used to communicate with SAC's bombers and the very low-frequency system used to contact the Navy's Polaris submarines relied on a handful of terminals that could easily be destroyed. According to one classified account, the Eisenhower administration had installed a one-shot command, control, and communication system. It hadn't been designed to fight a limited or prolonged nuclear war. The PSYOP required only that a go code be transmitted, and after that, nothing needed to be said, because nothing could be done to change or halt the execution of the war plan. The underground command posts were little more than hideouts where military and civilian leaders could ride out a nuclear attack and then emerge, perhaps, to rebuild the United States. America's early warning systems were also woefully inadequate. The Dew line of radar stations stretching across the Arctic, the Sage direction centers, the mighty Whirlwind II computers, built with great urgency at enormous expense, had been designed to track Soviet bombers. They could not detect Soviet missiles. The ballistic missile early warning system created for that task was just becoming operational. At best, the BMUs could spot missiles launched from the Soviet Union roughly 15 minutes before they hit the United States. But if the missiles were launched from Soviet submarines off the coast, the warning time would be zero. The BMUs couldn't detect missiles approaching at such a low altitude. And the reliability of the system, McNamara learned, still left much to be desired. During a tour of NORAD headquarters in Colorado Springs, Colorado, a few months earlier, Peter G. Peterson, the executive vice president of the Bell & Howell Company, had been allowed to sit in the commander's chair. Peterson was visiting the facility with Bell & Howell's president, Charles H. Percy, and Thomas J. Watson, Jr., the president of IBM. The first BMUs radar complex, located at Thule Air Base, Greenland, had come online that week, and the numerical threat levels of the new warning system were being explained to the businessmen. If the number one flashed in red above the world map, unidentified objects were traveling toward the United States. If the number three flashed, the threat level was high. SAC headquarters and the Joint Chiefs of Staff had to be notified immediately. The maximum threat level was five, a computer-generated warning with a 99.9% certainty that the United States was under attack. As Peterson sat in the commander's chair, the number above the map began to climb. When it reached four, NORAD officers ran into the room. When it reached five, Peterson and the other executives were quickly escorted out and put in a small office. The door was closed, and they were left there believing that a nuclear war had just begun. The vice commander of NORAD, Air Marshal C. Roy Slaman, a dapper Canadian with a small mustache, managed to track down the head of NORAD, General Lawrence S. Cooter, who was in an Air Force plane above South Dakota. "Chief, this is a hot one," Slaman said. The BMUs indicated that the Soviets had launched an all-out missile attack against North America. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were on the phone awaiting confirmation. The United States had only minutes to respond. "Where is Khrushchev?" Slaman asked his officers. "Khrushchev's in New York today, at the United Nations," NORAD's Chief of Intelligence said. Slaman immediately felt relieved. The Soviet Union was unlikely to launch an attack that would kill the first secretary of its Communist Party. 20 minutes passed, and no Soviet missiles landed. The three businessmen were led out of the small office, glad to be alive. When news of the false alarm leaked to the press, the Air Force denied that the missile warning had ever been taken seriously. Percy, who later became a Republican senator from Illinois, disputed that account. He recalled the sense of panic at NORAD. A subsequent investigation found the cause of the computer glitch.
The BMU's site at Thule had mistakenly identified the moon, slowly rising over Norway, as dozens of long-range missiles launched from Siberia. Both of America's early warning systems were deeply flawed, and as a result, the most reliable indicator of a Soviet attack might be the destruction of those systems by nuclear blasts. Bomb alarm system sensors would be placed at the SAGE direction centers and at Thule. By the time those bomb sensors went off, however, the president might already be dead. Of the 14 potential successors, as specified by Congress, only the vice president and the secretary of defense would have any familiarity with the PSYOP. If all 14 were in Washington, D.C. during a surprise attack, they would probably be killed or incapacitated. Amid the confusion, it might be impossible to determine who was America's commander-in-chief. Everyone on the presidential succession list had been given a phone number to call in case of a national emergency. The call would put them in touch with the Joint War Room at the Pentagon. But telephone service was bound to be disrupted by a nuclear attack. The Pentagon might no longer exist, and even if it did, the first person to call the War Room might be named President of the United States, regardless of whether he or she was next on the list. WSEG Report No. 50 outlined the problem. There is no mechanism for nor organization charged with locating, identifying, and providing essential defense communications to the senior non-incapacitated member of that list in the event of a nuclear attack presumed to have removed the president from control. The possibility exists that the man to wield presidential authority in dire emergency might in fact be selected by a single field-grade military officer. The idea of a decapitation attack aimed at America's military and civilian leadership didn't seem entirely far-fetched. Indeed, it was the most plausible scenario for a Soviet attack on the United States, and it had the best chance of success. No other target system can at present offer equal potential returns from so few weapons, the report said. McNamara subsequently discovered that the command and control problems were hardly limited to the United States. "We have been concerned with the vulnerability of our defense machine in the U.S., a Pentagon task force informed him, "but it is nothing compared with the situation in Europe. All of NATO's command bunkers, including the operations center inside the Kinzbach cave, could easily be destroyed, even by an attack with conventional weapons. Although NATO maintained fighter planes on a ground alert, ready to take off within 15 minutes, it lacked an early warning system that could detect Soviet missiles. It also lacked a bomb alarm system. At best, NATO commanders might receive 5 or 10 minutes of warning that a Soviet attack had begun. Not enough time to get those planes off the ground. And that warning would most likely never be received because the NATO communications system was completely unprotected. Its destruction would prevent NATO from transmitting messages not only within Europe, but also between Europe and the United States. Once the fighting began, the president could not expect to reach any of NATO's high-ranking officers or to give them any orders. And they wouldn't be able to communicate with one another." The Pentagon Task Force found that NATO had done little to prepare for the devolution of command in wartime. "It is imperative that each commander knows when a higher headquarters has been erased or isolated from command, that he knows his own responsibilities as the situation degrades, that he knows the status of similar commands at his level elsewhere, and that he knows the status of lower echelons and what responsibilities they can assume. It appears that this is not the case in Europe today." The absence of early warning capabilities, the poor communications, and the lack of any succession plan at NATO posed a grave, immediate risk. "Not only could we initiate a war through mistakes in Europe," McNamara was told, "but we could conceivably precipitate Soviet preemptive action because of a loose CNC, command and control, in Europe.
The situation was made even more dangerous by the pre-delegation authority that Eisenhower had secretly granted to the military. NATO units under attack were permitted to use their nuclear weapons without awaiting presidential approval. The new National Security Advisor, McGeorge Bundy, succinctly explained the rules to President Kennedy. A subordinate commander faced with a substantial Russian military action could start the thermonuclear holocaust on his own initiative if he could not reach you by failure of the communication at either end of the line. Any use of nuclear weapons in Europe, McNamara now believed, would quickly escalate to an all-out war. And the more he learned about America's nuclear deployments in Europe, the more he worried about such a catastrophe. 3 weeks after the Goldsboro accident, Congress's Joint Committee on Atomic Energy sent Kennedy and McNamara a top-secret report based on a recent tour of NATO bases. It warned that the risk of an accidental or unauthorized nuclear detonation in Europe was unacceptably high, not just in wartime, but also during routine NATO maneuvers. NATO's command and control problems were so bad, the bipartisan committee found, that in many respects the United States no longer had custody of its own nuclear weapons. Within months, the NATO stockpile would include atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs, thermonuclear warheads, nuclear artillery shells, nuclear depth charges, nuclear landmines, and the Davy Crockett, a recoilless rifle carried like a bazooka by an infantryman that fired small nuclear projectiles. But none of these weapons, except the landmines, formerly known as atomic demolition munitions, had any sort of lock to prevent somebody from setting them off without permission. And the three-digit mechanical locks on the landmines, like those often found on gym lockers, were easy to pick. According to one advisor, when Secretary of Defense McNamara heard that hundreds of American nuclear weapons stored in Europe were poorly guarded, vulnerable to theft, and unlocked, he almost fell out of his chair. The Joint Committee on Atomic Energy had been concerned for almost a year that NATO's custody arrangements were inadequate and in violation of American law. The Atomic Energy Act of 1946 strictly prohibited the transfer of nuclear weapons, as well as classified information about them, to foreign countries. The act was amended in 1954 so that NATO forces could be trained to use tactical weapons. After the launch of Sputnik, President Eisenhower asked Congress to change the law again and allow the creation of a NATO atomic stockpile. "I have always been of the belief that we should not deny to our allies," Eisenhower said, "what your potential enemy already has." His proposal was opposed by many in Congress who feared that it might be difficult to retain American control of nuclear weapons based in Europe. The Soviet Union strongly opposed the idea, too. Hatreds inspired by the Second World War still lingered, and the Soviets were especially upset by the prospect of German troops armed with nuclear weapons. In order to gain congressional approval, the Eisenhower administration promised that the weapons would remain at all times under the supervision of American military personnel. The nuclear corps would be held by the United States until the outbreak of war, and then the corps would be handed over to NATO forces. Secretary of State Christian A. Herter assured the Soviet Union that an essential element of the NATO stockpile would be that custody of atomic warheads remains exclusively with the United States. On January 1, 1960, General Loris Norstad, the supreme Allied commander in Europe, placed all of NATO's nuclear-capable units on a 15-minute alert without consulting Congress. Every NATO air squadron was ordered to keep at least two fighter planes loaded with fuel and a nuclear weapon parked near a runway. And thermonuclear warheads were mated to the intermediate-range Jupiter missiles in Italy and the Thor missiles in Great Britain. The new alert policy had the full support of President Eisenhower, who thought that NATO should be able to respond promptly to a Soviet attack.
Eisenhower had faith in the discipline of NATO forces, and he had most likely a private understanding with Norstad similar to the one made with LeMay, granting the permission to use nuclear weapons if Washington, D.C. had been destroyed or couldn't be reached during a wartime emergency. The Supreme Commander of NATO reported directly to the President, not to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Norstad was fiercely protective of his authority. He disliked General Thomas Power, the head of the Strategic Air Command, and wanted to preserve NATO's ability to destroy the Soviet Union without any help from SAC. The thermonuclear warheads atop NATO's Jupiter missiles were aimed at Soviet cities. With those missiles, and the hundreds of other nuclear weapons under NATO command, Norstad could conceivably fight his own war against the Soviets on his own terms. Members of the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy visited 15 NATO bases in December 1960, eager to see how America's nuclear weapons were being deployed. The group was accompanied by Harold Agnew, the Los Alamos physicist who'd come up with the idea of attaching parachutes to hydrogen bombs and later helped to develop one-point safety standards. Agnew was an expert on how to design bombs and how to handle them properly. At a NATO base in Germany, Agnew looked out at the runway and, in his own words, nearly wet my pants. The F-84F fighter planes on alert, each carrying a fully assembled Mark 7 bomb, were being guarded by a single American soldier. Agnew walked over and asked the young enlisted man, who carried an old-fashioned bolt-action rifle, what he'd do if somebody jumped into one of the planes and tried to take off. Would he shoot at the pilot or the bomb? The soldier had never been told what to do. The wings of the fighters were decorated with the Iron Cross, a symbol that powerfully evoked two world wars. Agnew realized there was little to prevent a German pilot from taking a plane, flying it to the Soviet Union, and dropping an atomic bomb. The custody arrangements at the Jupiter missile sites in Italy were even more alarming. Each site had three missiles topped with a 1.4 megaton warhead, a weapon capable of igniting firestorms and flattening every brick structure within 30 square miles. All the security was provided by Italian troops. The launch authentication officer